Our Country, the Marvel of Nations, Chapter 15, Practical Workings. How the principles set forth in the foregoing pages operate in actual application has been shown in events that have taken place in Arkansas and Tennessee since the edition of 1883 of this work went to press, which reveal the practical workings of a Sunday law whenever and wherever it may be secured. The attention of the people in some places in Arkansas was being called to the importance of observing the seventh day of the week as the Sabbath, according to the fourth commandment of the Decalogue, by the advocates of that faith. As converts to that view and practice began to appear, strong opposition was excited on the part of some, as it has been in other places, and as truth has always excited opposition ever since error has endeavored to usurp control over the minds of men. How far the action which followed was owing to this opposition, we do not say. We only state the facts and leave the reader to draw his own conclusions. In the winter of 1884-85, a bill was introduced into the legislature of that state to abolish the clause in the existing Sunday law which exempted from its operation those who conscientiously observed the seventh day. Up to this time, the laws of that state had been very just and liberal in this respect. But now a position was presented that the exemption clause be stricken out, bringing all alike, without regard to their religious faith or practice, under subjection to the enactment to keep the first day of the week as the Sabbath. The petition claimed to have been called out by the fact that certain Jews in Little Rock, regarding the seventh day as the Sabbath, kept open stores and transacted their usual business on the first day of the week. Considering the fact that their places of business were open also on the seventh day, this brought them into unfair competition with the other merchants of the place. There was certainly no necessity for a change of the law to meet this difficulty, for the law exempted those only who conscientiously observed the seventh day, and these Jews, by keeping open places of business on the seventh day, showed that there was no such conscientious observance on their part, and consequently, that they could not justly claim the exemption of the law. But ostensibly on this ground, the petition was urged, and the repeal of the exempting clause secured.
What was the result? We have not learned that the aforesaid Jews in Little Rock or any other part of the state were molested, that railroads, hotel keepers, liverymen, or those engaged in any like vocations were in any wise restrained. But those persons above referred to, who, from a Christian point of view, had commenced to observe the seventh day in preference to the first, who were not engaged in such business as brought them into competition with others, who, having conscientiously observed the seventh day, proposed to go quietly, soberly, and industriously about their lawful business on the first day of the week, these soon found that they were not overlooked. Warrants were promptly issued for the arrest of some five or six of these, one of them, J.W. Scholes, a minister, whose offense was that he was engaged one Sunday in the boisterous work of painting a meeting house erected by his people. The trial of these persons came off at Fayetteville, Arkansas, the first week in November, 1885. In making up the indictment, an observer of the seventh day was called in to testify against his brethren. The following examination substantially took place. Do you know anyone about here who is violating the Sunday law? Yes. Who? The Frisco Railroad is running several trains each way on that day. Do you know of any others? Yes. Who? The hotels of this place are open and doing a full run of business on Sunday as on other days. Any others? Yes, the druggists and barbers. Any others? Yes, the livery stable men do more business on that day than on any other. As these were not the parties the court was after, the question was finally asked directly. Do you know of any Seventh-day Adventists who have worked on Sunday? Ascertaining that some of this class had been guilty of labor on that day, indictments were issued for five persons accordingly. At the trial, the defendants employed the best counsel obtainable, Judge Walker, ex-member of the United States Senate. The points he made before the court were that the law was unconstitutional. First, because it was an infringement of religious freedom, or the right of conscience, inasmuch as it compelled men to keep as the Sabbath a day which their conscience and the Bible taught them was not the Sabbath.
Secondly,
because it was an infringement of the right of property, taking from seventh-day keepers 1/6 part of their time, and the time of a laboring man being his property, the law was, in its nature, a robber. And, thirdly, because it took away a right that God had given, the right to labor 6 days and to rest one. All this was overruled by the judge, who charged that the law rested equally upon all, requiring that all men should rest one day, and that the first day of the week, which requirement rested alike on the Methodists, the Baptists, the Congregationalists, the Sabbatarians, the Jews, worldlings, and infidels. And if our religion required us to keep another day, that was a price we paid to our religion, and with that the state had nothing to do. He ruled, moreover, that no one had a right to set up his conscience against the law of the land. From these denials of the rights which the author of their existence has given to all men, namely, their right to labor 6 days and to rest on the seventh, and the right to obey God rather than man when man's requirements conflict with his, the counsel for the defendants, of course, took appeal, and the case went up to the Supreme Court of the state to be tried in May 1886. Others were indicted during this year till the number of prosecutions reached 21. During the same time, a similar work went on in Tennessee, where Seventh-day views had been more extensively agitated. 8 persons in that state were prosecuted for Sunday labor. 3 of the number were convicted on a charge of flagrant violation of the Christian Sabbath. The charge was preferred by a professor of religion, but 2 of the men were quietly plowing in their fields a full half mile from the house of the one who lodged complaint against them. In these cases, a fine of $20 and costs was imposed on each. Appeal was taken to the Supreme Court of the state, which convened in Jackson in May 1886, the parties having meanwhile to give bail of $250 each for their appearance in court at that time. In regard to the state of public sentiment in Tennessee on this question, S. Fulton, a minister, then of Springville, Henry County, Tennessee, wrote,
"Public sentiment is fast changing here in favor of Sunday legislation. Some 7 years ago, a Mr. Thomason, a lawyer of Paris, Tennessee, in consulting with our brethren on the question of Sunday labor, advised them to pursue their work on Sunday, claiming that they could not be harmed for it, as the Constitution granted them that right. Since then, he has professed religion and joined the Presbyterian Church, and now says that we must quit work on the Christian Sabbath or suffer punishment by law, and there is no avoiding it." Speaking of the trial, he says, "In the courtroom, the attorney for the defendant asked the question if Sunday was the Sabbath, and the judge ruled it out as not a proper question. Neither would he permit a statement to be made why our brethren worked on Sunday. In his charge to the jury, it was easily seen that he was determined to have them punished. The jury had hardly left the room when they returned a verdict of guilty, and a fine of $20 and costs was imposed on each. Our brethren then appealed to the Supreme Court, in the hope that some justice might be shown them there. The Supreme Court in all these cases confirmed the decision of the lower court. In Arkansas, those who were convicted paid their fines, but the obnoxious law was repealed in January 1887. In Tennessee, the victims of the persecutions served out their sentences in jail. A visitor of the same faith describes the case in these words:
"The brethren, knowing that they had done no evil, and feeling that to pay their hard-earned money on such a charge would be to put a premium on injustice, decided to go to jail and suffer for the truth's sake. The jailer manifested a spirit of kindness, taking them home to supper with his own family, and otherwise doing all the law allowed him to do for their comfort. Being desirous of seeing the jail, I was permitted to enter. From the hall, we entered the rooms occupied by the prisoners. The one our brethren occupy is about 8 by 10 feet. Upon the floor were mattresses made of seagrass with blankets for covering, but no pillows, nor bed linen, nor a piece of furniture of any kind. In this apartment our brethren are placed to remain nearly 6 months for serving God according to their own consciences and in obedience to the Scriptures.
Is it any wonder the prophet, as he was shown the acts of this government, said that it spake like a dragon? Can our opponents say longer that observers of the seventh day will never be persecuted? To deny it to be religious persecution would be to deny the plainest facts in the case. If it is not, why do businessmen, hack drivers, livery stable keepers, saloon keepers, hunters, fishers, etc., do whatever they please on Sunday and yet go free, while these men who conscientiously keep the seventh day and then go quietly about their work on Sunday are torn from their homes, deprived of their freedom, and imprisoned? In the findings of the Supreme Court of Arkansas, confirming the decision of the lower court, the following sentiments were advanced. It is said that every day in the week is observed by some one of the religious sects of the world as a day of rest. And if the power is denied to fix by law Sunday as such a day, the same reason would prevent the selection of any day. But the power of the legislature to select a day as a holiday is everywhere conceded. The state from the beginning has appropriated Sunday as such. The law which imposes the penalty operates upon all alike and interferes with no man's religious belief. For in limiting the prohibition to secular pursuits, it leaves religious profession and worship free.
The appellant's argument, then, is reduced to this, that because he conscientiously believes that he is permitted by the law of God to labor on Sunday, he may violate with impunity a statute declaring it illegal to do so. But a man's religion cannot be accepted as a justification for committing an overt act made criminal by the law of the land. If the law operates harshly, as laws sometimes do, the remedy is in the hands of the legislature. It is not in the province of the judiciary to pass upon the wisdom and policy of legislation, that is, for the members of the legislative department. And the only appeal from their determination is to the constituency. In relation to the foregoing, it may be remarked that the assertion that all days are kept by different classes, and therefore the state could not fix upon any day as a holiday without taking somebody's Sabbath, is not true. Only 3 days are regarded as sacred days. These are the Sabbath of the Lord, and the two thieves between which it is crucified, the Friday of Muhammad, and the Sunday of the Pope. The plea that the Sunday law interferes with no man's religion is a specious one, but one which is shown by a moment's reflection to be utterly false. A man's religion is interfered with when discrimination is made in favor of another man's religion and against his own, and when he cannot be true to the convictions of his own conscience in regard to those spiritual duties which he owes alone to God, without incurring, in consequence, hardship and loss. And this is precisely what the Sunday law does in reference to observers of the seventh day. But it is said that the state in its legislation has no reference to the religious character of Sunday. This is too flimsy a pretext behind which to hide, for it is written all over the transaction in characters which cannot be hidden, that Sunday is elevated to the position of the state rest day simply and solely because so many church people regard it as a religious institution. It is utterly impossible to separate it from this idea or to attribute it to any other cause. Any defense attempted on this line is sheer sophistry. And the doctrine set forth in the foregoing quotation, that the law of the land can make acts criminal which God permits in our worship of Himself, is little short of monstrous.
At the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists, held in Battle Creek, Michigan, November 18th to December 6th, 1886, it was decided to appeal the case of J.W. Scholes, referred to on page 280, to the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court in the foregoing cases confirmed the decision of the lower court, but in Arkansas, the legislature repealed the law in January 1887. In Tennessee, it still remains in force.